Similar finds at Baradostin are estimated to be 30,000 years old. Figures, tombs and stone implements at Tepezi Ab are dated 13,000 years back. Petrified excrement, which is possibly not of human origin, was found at the same place. Tools and stone engravers were found at Karim Shahir. Flint weapons and tools were excavated at Barda Balka. Skeletons of grown men and a child were found in the cave of Shandia. They were dated, by the C14 method, to about 45,000 BC. The list could be considerably enlarged and every fact would strengthen the assertion that a mixture of primitive men lived in the geographical territory of Sumer about 40,000 years ago. Suddenly, for reasons inexplicable so far, the Sumerians were though with their astronomy, their culture and their technology. The conclusions to be drawn from the previous presence on Earth of unknown visitors from the universe are still purely speculative. We can imagine that gods appeared who collected the semi-savage peoples in the region of Sumer around them and transmitted some of their knowledge to them. The figurines and statues that stare at us today from the glass cases of museums show a racial mixture, with goggle eyes, domed foreheads, narrow lips and mostly long straight noses. A picture that is very difficult to fit into the schematic system of thought and its concept of primitive peoples. Visitors from the universe in remote antiquity? In the Lebanon there are glass-like bits of rock, so-called tektites, in which the American Dr. Steyr discovered radioactive aluminium isotopes. In Egypt and Iraq there were finds of cut crystal lenses which today can only be made using cesium oxide, in other words an oxide that has to be won by electrochemical processes. In Helwan there is a piece of cloth, a fabric so fine that it could only be woven today in a special factory with great technical know-how and experience. Electric dry batteries, which work on the galvanic principle, are on display in Baghdad Museum. In the same place the visitor can see electric elements with copper electrodes and an unknown electrolyte. In the mountainous Asian region of Kohistan a cave drawing reproduces the exact position of the constellations as they actually were 10,000 years ago. Venus and the Earth are joined by lines. Ornaments of platinum were found on the Peruvian plateau. Parts of a belt made of aluminium lay in a grave at Chuchu, China. At Delhi there is an ancient pillar made of iron which contains neither phosphorus nor sulfur and so cannot be destroyed by the effects of the weather. This strange medley of impossibilities should make us curious and uneasy. By what means, with what intuition, did the primitive cave dwellers manage to draw the constellations in their correct positions? From what precision workshop did the cut crystal lenses come? How could anyone smelt and model platinum, since platinum only begins to melt at temperatures of 1,800 degrees Celsius? And how did the ancient Chinese make aluminium, a metal which can only be extracted from bauxite with considerable difficulty? Impossible questions, to be sure, but does that mean that we should not ask them? Since we are not prepared to accept or admit that there was a higher culture or an equally perfect technology before our own, all that is left is the hypothesis of a visit from space. As long as archaeology is conducted as it has been so far, we shall never have a chance to discover whether our dim past was really dim and not perhaps quite enlightened. A utopian archaeological year is due, during which archaeologists, physicists, chemists, geologists, metallurgists, and all the corresponding branches of these sciences ought to concentrate their efforts on one single question: did our forefathers receive visits from outer space? For example, a metallurgist would be able to tell an archaeologist quickly and concisely how complicated the production of aluminium is. Is it not conceivable that a physicist might instantly recognize a formula in a rock drawing? A chemist with his highly developed apparatus might be able to confirm the assumption that obelisks were extracted from the rock by wetting wooden wedges or using unknown acids. The geologist owes us a whole series of answers to questions about what is of significance in certain ice age deposits. The team for a utopian archaeological year would naturally include a group of divers who would investigate the Dead Sea for radioactive traces of an atomic explosion over Sodom and Gomorrah. Why are the oldest libraries in the world secret libraries? What are people really afraid of? Are they worried that the truth, protected and concealed for so many thousands of years, will finally come to light? Research and progress cannot be held back. For 4,000 years the Egyptians considered their gods to be real beings. In the Middle Ages we still killed witches in our burning ideological zeal. The belief of the ancient Greeks that they could tell the future from a goose's entrails is as out of date today as the conviction of ultra-conservatives that nationalism still has the slightest importance. We have 1,001 errors of the past to correct. The self-assurance that is feigned is threadbare and is really only an acute form of stubbornness. At the conference tables or orthodox scientists, the delusion still prevails that a thing must be proved before a serious person may, or can, concern himself with it. In the past, the man who put forward a brand new idea had to count on being despised and persecuted by the church and his colleagues. Things must have become easier, one thinks. There are no more anathemas, and fires at the stake are no longer lit. The snag is that the methods of our time are less spectacular, but they are hardly less obstructive to progress. Now everything is more civilized and there is much less fuss. Theories and intolerably audacious ideas are hushed up or dismissed by killer phrases, as the Americans say. There are many possibilities, it's against the rules. Always a good one, it's not classical enough. Bound to impress. It's too revolutionary. Unequaled in its deterrent effect. The universities won't go along with that. Convincing. Others have already tried that. Of course. But were they successful? We can't see any sense in it. And that's that. That hasn't been proved yet. Quoderat demonstrandum. 500 years ago, a scientist cried out in the law courts, "Common sense must tell anyone that the Earth cannot possibly be a ball, otherwise the people on the lower half would fall into the void." "Nowhere in the Bible," asserted another, "does it say that the Earth revolves round the sun." Consequently, every such assertion is the work of the devil. It seems as if narrow-mindedness was always a special characteristic when new worlds of ideas were beginning. But on the threshold of the 21st century, the research worker should be prepared for fantastic realities. He should be eager to revise laws and knowledge which were considered sacrosanct for centuries, but are nevertheless called in question by new knowledge, even if a reactionary army tries to dam up this new intellectual flood. A new world must be conquered in the teeth of all the unteachable, in the name of truth and reality. Anyone who spoke about satellites in scientific circles 20 years ago was committing a kind of academic suicide. Today, artificial heavenly bodies, namely satellites, revolve round the sun. They have photographed Mars and landed smoothly on the Moon and Venus, radioing first-class photographs of the unknown landscape back to Earth with their tourist cameras. When the first such photos were radioed to Earth from Mars in the spring of 1958, the strength used was 0.000000000000001 watts, an almost incredibly weak output. Yet nothing is incredible any longer. The word impossible should have become literally impossible for the modern scientist. Anyone who does not accept this today will be crushed by the reality tomorrow. So let us stick tenaciously to our theory, according to which astronauts from distant planets visited the Earth thousands of years ago. We know that our ingenuous and primitive forefathers did not know what to make of the astronauts' superior technology. They worshipped the astronauts as gods who came from other stars, and the astronauts had no other choice but patiently to accept their adoration as divinities. A homage, incidentally, for which our astronauts on unknown planets must be quite prepared. Some parts of our Earth are still inhabited by primitive peoples to whom a machine gun is a weapon of the devil. In that case, a jet aircraft may well be an angelic vehicle to them. And a voice coming from a radio set the voice of a god. These last primitive peoples, too, naively hand down from generation to generation in their sagas their impressions of technical achievements that we take for granted. They still scratch their divine figures and their wonderful ships coming from heaven on cliffs and cave walls. In this way, these savage peoples have actually preserved for us what we are seeking today. Cave drawings in Kyrgyzstan, France, North America and southern Rhodesia, in the Sahara and Peru, as well as Chile, all contribute to our theory. Henri Lhout, a French scholar, discovered at Tassili, Sahara, several hundred walls painted with many thousands of pictures of animals and men, including figures in short elegant coats. They carry sticks and undefinable chests on the sticks. Next to the animal paintings, we are astonished by a being in a kind of diver's suit. The great god Mars, so Lhout christened him, was originally over 18 feet high, but the savage who bequeathed the drawing to us can scarcely have been as primitive as we should like him to be, if everything is to fit neatly into the old pattern of thought. After all, the savage obviously used a scaffolding to be able to draw in proportion like that, for there have been no shifts in ground level in these caves during the last few millennia. Without overstretching my imagination, I get the impression that the great god Mars is depicted in a space or diving suit. On his heavy powerful shoulders rests a helmet which is connected to his torso by a kind of joint. There are a number of slits on the helmet where mouth and nose would normally be. One would readily believe that it was the result of chance or even in the pictorial imagination of the prehistoric artist if this picture was unique. But there are several of these clumsy figures with the same equipment at Tassili, and very similar figures have also been found on rock faces in the USA, in the Tulare region of California. I should like to be generous, and I am willing to postulate that the primitive artists were unskilled and portrayed the figures in this rather crude way because it was the best they could do. But in that case, why could the same primitive cave dwellers depict animals and normal human beings to perfection? So it seems more credible to me to assume that the artists were perfectly capable of drawing what they actually saw. In Inyo County, California, a geometrical figure in a cave drawing is recognizable, without overstraining the imagination, as a normal slide rule in a double frame. The archaeological opinion is that the drawing shows figures of the gods. An animal of unknown species with gigantic upright horns on its head appears on a pottery vessel found at Sialk in Iran. Why not? But both horns display five spirals to left and right. If you imagine two rods with large porcelain insulators, that is roughly what this drawing looks like. What do the archaeologists say to that? Quite simply that they are symbols of a god. Gods are good value. People explain a great deal, certainly everything that is unexplained, by referring to their unknowableness and supernaturalness. In this world of the undemonstrable, they can live in peace. Every figurine that is found, every artifact that is put together, every figure that can be restored from fragments, they are all instantly associated with some ancient religion or other. But if an object cannot be fitted into any of the existing religions, even forcibly, some new crackpot old cult is rapidly conjured up, like a rabbit out of a top hat, the sum works out once again. But what if the frescoes, at Tassili or in the USA, or in France, actually reproduce what the primitive peoples saw? What should we say if the spirals on the rods really depicted antennae, just as the primitive peoples had seen them on the unfamiliar gods? Isn't it possible that things which ought not to exist do in fact exist? A savage, who nevertheless was skillful enough to execute wall paintings, cannot really have been so savage. The wall drawing of the White Lady of Brandenburg, South Africa, could be a 20th century painting. She wears a short-sleeved pullover, closely fitting breeches, and gloves, garters and slippers. The lady is not alone. Behind her stands a thin man with a strange prickly rod in his hand and wearing a very complicated helmet with a kind of visor. This would be accepted as a modern painting without hesitation, but the snag is that we are dealing with a cave drawing. All the gods who are depicted in cave drawings in Sweden and Norway have uniform undefinable heads. The archaeologists say that they are animal heads. Yet isn't there something rather absurd about worshipping a god whom one also slaughters and eats? We often see ships with wings and even more frequently typical antennae. Figures in bulky suits occur again in Valcamonica, Brescia, Italy, and, annoyingly enough, they also have horns on their heads. I am not going so far as to claim that the Italian cave dwellers shuttled backwards and forwards between North America or Sweden, the Sahara and Spain, Ciudad Real, to transmit their illustrative talents and ideas. Yet the awkward question is left hanging in the air, why did the primitive peoples create figures in bulky suits with antennae on their heads independently of each other? I should not waste a word on these unexplained oddities if they only existed in one place in the world. But they are found almost everywhere. As soon as we look at the past with our present-day gaze and use the fantasy of our technological age to fill up the gaps in it, the veils that shroud the darkness begin to lift. In the next chapter, a study of ancient holy books will help me to make my theory such a credible reality that in the long run the investigators of our past will no longer be able to evade the revolutionary questions. Chapter 4, Was God an Astronaut? The Bible is full of secrets and contradictions. Genesis, for example, begins with the creation of the earth, which is reported with absolute geological accuracy. But how did the chronicler know that minerals preceded plants and plants preceded animals? And God said, "Let us make man in our image, after our likeness," we read in Genesis 1:26. Why does God speak in the plural? Why does he say us, not me, why are and not my? One would think that the one and only God ought to address mankind in the singular, not in the plural. And it came to pass, when men began to multiply on the face of the earth, and daughters were born unto them, that the sons of God saw the daughters of men that they were fair, and they took them wives of all which they chose. Genesis 6:1-2. Who can tell us what sons of God took the daughters of men to wife? Ancient Israel had a single sacrosanct God. Where do the sons of God come from? There were giants in the earth in those days, and also after that, when the sons of God came in unto the daughters of men, and they bare children to them, the same became mighty men which were of old, men of renown. Genesis 6:4, once again we have the sons of God, who interbreed with human beings. Here, too, we have the first mention of giants. Giants keep on cropping up in all parts of the globe, in the mythology of East and West, in the sagas of Diurnico and the epics of the Eskimos. Giants haunt the pages of almost all ancient books. So they must have existed. What sort of creatures were they, these giants? Were they our forefathers, who built the gigantic buildings and effortlessly manhandled the monoliths, or were they technically skilled space travelers from another star? One thing is certain. The Bible speaks of giants and describes them as sons of God, and these sons of God breed with the daughters of men and multiply. We are given a very exciting and detailed account of the catastrophe of Sodom and Gomorrah in Genesis 19:1-28. Two angels came to Sodom in the evening when Father Lot was sitting near the town gate. Obviously Lot was expecting these angels, who soon proved to be men, because he recognized them at once and hospitably invited them to spend the night in his house. The men of the town, says the Bible, wanted to know the strangers. But the two strangers were able to dispel the local playboy's sexual lust with a single gesture. They smote the mischief makers with blindness. According to Genesis 19:12-14, the angels told Lot to take his wife, sons and daughters, and sons-in-law and daughters-in-law, out of the town with all speed, for, they warned him, it would be destroyed very soon. The family were unwilling to believe this strange warning and took the whole thing for one of Father Lot's bad jokes. And Genesis continues, And when the morning arose, then the angels hastened Lot, saying, Arise, take thy wife, and thy two daughters, which are here, lest thou be consumed in the iniquity of the city. And while he lingered, the men laid hold upon his hand, and upon the hand of his wife, and upon the hand of his two daughters, the Lord being merciful unto him, and they brought him forth, and set him without the city. And it came to pass, when they had brought them forth abroad, that he said, Escape for thy life, look not behind thee, neither stay thou in the plain, escape to the mountain, lest thou be consumed. Haste thee, escape thither, for I cannot do anything till thou be come thither. According to this report, there is no doubt that the two strangers, the angels, possessed a power unknown to the inhabitants. The suggestive urgency, the speed with which they drove the Lot family on, also make us think. When Father Lot tarried, they pulled him along by the hands. They had to get away in a matter of minutes. Lot, they ordered, must go into the mountains and he must not turn round. Nevertheless, Father Lot does not seem to have had unlimited respect for the angels, because he keeps on making objections, apostrophe. I cannot escape to the mountain lest some evil take me, and I die. A little later the angels say that they cannot do anything for him if he does not go with them. What actually happened at Sodom? We cannot imagine that Almighty God is tied down to a timetable. Then why were his angels in such a hurry? Or was the destruction of the city by some power or other fixed to the very minute? Had the countdown already begun and did the angels know about it? In that case the moment of destruction would obviously have been imminent. Was there no simpler method of bringing the Lot family to safety? Why did they have to go into there? Mountains at all costs? And why on earth should they be forbidden to look round again? Admittedly, these are awkward questions about a serious matter. But since the dropping of two atomic bombs on Japan, we know the kind of damage such bombs cause and that living creatures exposed to direct radiation die or become incurably ill. Let us imagine for a moment that Sodom and Gomorrah were destroyed according to plan, that is deliberately, by a nuclear explosion. Perhaps, let us speculate a little further. The angels simply wanted to destroy some dangerous fissionable material and at the same time to make sure of wiping out a human brood they found unpleasant. The time for the destruction was fixed. Those who were to escape it, such as the Lot family, had to stay a few miles from the center of the explosion in the mountains, for the rock faces would naturally absorb the powerful dangerous rays. And, we all know the story. Lot's wife turned round and looked straight at the atomic sun. Nowadays no one is surprised that she fell dead on the spot. Then the Lord rained upon Sodom and upon Gomorrah brimstone and fire. And this is how the account of the catastrophe ends, Genesis 19:27-28, and Abraham got up early in the morning to the place where he stood before the Lord, and he looked toward Sodom and Gomorrah, and toward all the land of the plain. And beheld, and, lo, the smoke of the country went up as the smoke of a furnace. We may be as religious as our fathers, but we are certainly less credulous. With the best will in the world we cannot imagine an omnipotent, ubiquitous, infinitely good God who is above all concepts of time and yet does not know what is going to happen. God created man and was satisfied with his work. However, he seems to have repented of his deed later, because this same Creator decided to destroy mankind. It is also difficult for us enlightened children of this age to think of an infinitely good Father who gives preference to favorite children, such as Lot's family, over countless others. The Old Testament gives some impressive descriptions in which God alone or his angels fly straight down from heaven making a tremendous noise and issuing clouds of smoke. One of the most original descriptions of such incidents comes to us from the prophet Ezekiel. Now it came to pass in the 30th year, in the 4th month, in the 5th day of the month, as I was among the captives by the river of Chebar, that the heavens were opened. And I looked, and, behold, a whirlwind came out of the north, a great cloud, and a fire unfolding itself, and a brightness was about it, and out of the midst thereof as the color of amber, out of the midst of the fire. Also out of the midst thereof came the likeness of four living creatures. And this was their appearance, they had the likeness of a man. And every one had four faces, and every one had four wings. And their feet were straight feet, and the sole of their feet was like the sole of a calf's foot, and they sparkled like the color of burnished brass. Ezekiel gives precise details of the landing of this vehicle. He describes a craft that comes from the north, emitting rays and gleaming and raising a gigantic cloud of desert sand. Now the God of the Old Testament was supposed to be omnipotent. Then why does this Almighty God have to come hurtling up from a particular direction? Cannot he be anywhere he wants without all this noise and fuss? Let us follow Ezekiel's eyewitness account a little further. Now as I beheld the living creatures, behold one wheel upon the earth by the living creatures, with his four faces. The appearance of the wheels and their work was like unto the color of a beryl, and they four had one likeness, and their appearance and their work were as it were a wheel in the middle of a wheel. When they went upon their four sides, and they turned not as they went. As for their rings, they were so high that they were dreadful, and their rings were full of eyes round about them four. And when the living creatures went, the wheels went by them, and when the living creatures were lifted up from the earth, the wheels were lifted up. The description is astonishingly good. Ezekiel says that each wheel was in the middle of another one. An optical illusion. To our present way of thinking, what he saw was one of those special vehicles the Americans use in the desert and swampy terrain. Ezekiel observed that the wheels rose from the ground simultaneously with the winged creatures. He was quite right. Naturally, the wheels of a multi-purpose vehicle, say an amphibious helicopter, do not stay on the ground when it takes off. More from Ezekiel, son of man, stand upon thy feet, and I will speak unto thee. The narrator heard this voice and hid his face in the ground in fear and trembling. The strange apparitions addressed Ezekiel as son of man and wanted to talk to him. The account goes on, apostrophe. And I heard behind me a voice of a great rushing, saying, Blessed be the glory of the Lord from this place. I heard also the noise of the wings of the living creatures that touched one another, and the noise of the wheels over against them, and a noise of great rushing. In addition to his precise description of the vehicle, Ezekiel also noted the noise the novel monstrosity made when it left the ground. He likens the din made by the wings and the wheels to a great rushing. Surely this suggests that this is an eyewitness account? The gods spoke to Ezekiel and told him that it was his task to restore law and order to the country. They took him with them in their vehicle and confirmed that they had not yet forsaken the country. This experience made a strong impression on Ezekiel, for he never tires of describing the weird vehicle. On three more occasions he says that each wheel was in the middle of a wheel and that the four wheels could go on their four sides. And turned not as they went. And he was particularly impressed by the fact that the whole body of the vehicle, the backs, the hands, the wings and even the wheels were full of eyes. The gods reveal the purpose and goal of their journey to the chronicler later when they tell him that he is living in the midst of a rebellious house which has eyes to see and sees not and ears to hear and hears not. Once he has been enlightened about his countrymen, the follow, as in all descriptions of such landings, advice and directions for law and order, as well as hints for creating a proper civilization. Ezekiel took the task very seriously and handed on the instructions of the gods. Once again we are confronted with all kinds of questions. Who spoke to Ezekiel? What sort of beings were they? They were certainly not gods in the traditional sense of the word, or they would not have needed a vehicle to move from one place to another. This kind of locomotion seems to me to be quite incompatible with the idea of an almighty God. In this connection, there is another technical invention in the Book of Books, which is worthwhile examining impartially. In Exodus 25, 10, Moses relates the exact instructions which God gave for building the Ark of the Covenant. The directions are given to the very inch, how and where staves and rings are to be fitted and from what alloy the metals are to be made. The instructions were meant to ensure that everything was carried out exactly as God wanted it. He warned Moses several times not to make any mistakes.